From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A break from typical and regularly scheduled conversations on this program as we respond to the events in Dallas and some of the tragedies across the country. Of course, we know that on Thursday night, five Dallas police officers were shot and killed near the conclusion of a Black Lives Matter protest and march. It had been a peaceful protest and march up to that point, with Dallas police officers doing their best to make sure the protesters felt protected and safe. The Dallas Police Department's Twitter account had even tweeted pictures of officers with protesters hand in hand, arm in arm, working together. Dallas police say they know that peaceful demonstration is a part of the fabric of this country and they wanted to help. But then someone, at least one suspect, perhaps more, opened fire on police. Five officers killed, others were injured. And those are some of the events that we're focusing on today. Of course, those events, that demonstration in Dallas, preceded by a number of incidents in which police officers in different American cities killed African-American men after confrontations. And to many Americans, and in particular to the Black community, those killings do not look justified. They sparked some of those demonstrations, and certainly the one in Dallas. So this hour, we're going to have a conversation about what happened. But first, we want to listen to the comments of Loretta Lynch. She is addressing some of these events as well, NPR, with some special programming. So let's listen to Attorney General Loretta Lynch, and then we'll come back and have a conversation on Connections.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for being here today. Last night, at least five police officers were shot and killed. Several more were injured, along with two civilians, as they sought to protect a peaceful protest in Dallas, Texas. Our thoughts and our prayers and condolences go out to the families of those who have lost loved ones. The Department of Justice, including the FBI, ATF, the U.S. Marshals Service, and the U.S. Attorney's Office on the scene, is working closely with our state and local counterparts, and we intend to provide any assistance that we can to investigate this attack and also to help heal a community that has been severely shaken and deeply scarred by an unfathomable tragedy. This is an unfolding situation. We'll be providing additional information when it is available and appropriate. But more so, this has been a week of profound grief and heartbreaking loss. The peaceful protest that was planned in Dallas last night was organized in response to the tragic deaths of Alton Sterling in Louisiana and Philando Castile in Minnesota. Now, we've opened a civil rights investigation in Louisiana, and we're providing assistance to local authorities in Minnesota who are leading the investigation there. And today, we are feeling the devastating loss of Dallas area Rapid Transit Officer Brent Thompson and four other fallen officers whose names remain unreleased as we await notification to all of the families. Now, after the events of this week, Americans across our country are feeling a sense of helplessness, of uncertainty, and of fear. Now, these feelings are understandable and they are justified, but the answer must not be violence. The answer is never violence. Rather, the answer, our answer, all our answer, must be action. Calm, peaceful, collaborative, and determined action. We must continue working to build trust between communities and law enforcement. We must continue working to guarantee every person in this country equal justice under the law. And we must take a hard look at the ease with which wrongdoers can get their hands on deadly weapons and the frequency with which they use them. And we must reflect on the kind of country that we want to build and the kind of society that we are choosing to pass on to our children. And above all, we must reject the easy impulses of bitterness and rancor and embrace the difficult work, but the important work, the vital work, of finding a path forward together. And above everything, we must remind ourselves that we're all Americans, and that as Americans, we share not just a common land, but a common life. Not just common goals, but a common heart and soul. And those we've lost this week have come from different backgrounds, different neighborhoods, but today they're mourned by officers, by residents, by family and friends, by men and women and children who loved them, who needed them, and who will miss them always. They are mourned by all of us. To the families of all who've lost their lives in this series of tragedies, we share your pain and your loss. To our brothers and sisters who wear the badge, I want you to know that I am deeply grateful for the difficult and dangerous work that you do every day to keep our streets safe and our nation secure. Our hearts are broken by this loss. And the Department of Justice will do all that we can to support you in the days ahead. And to those who seek to improve our country through peaceful protest and protected speech, I want you to know that your voice is important. Do not be discouraged by those who would use your lawful actions as a cover for their heinous violence. We will continue to safeguard your constitutional rights and to work with you in the difficult mission of building a better nation and a brighter future. And to all Americans, I ask you, I implore you, do not let this week precipitate a new normal in this country. I ask you to turn to each other, not against each other, as we move forward. Let us support one another. Let us help heal one another. And I urge you to remember, today and every day, that we are one nation, we are one people, and we stand together. May God bless the families and the loved ones of all who were taken from us this week, and comfort their grief with his everlasting grace. And may God bless the United States of America. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You were listening to Attorney General Loretta Lynch delivering her prepared remarks via NPR News. And we are going to devote both hours of Connections today to discussing those tragedies and the way forward. We are breaking from what had been scheduled programming for Connections, as we sometimes do in response to events as it warrants, and we are going to devote both of the hours to the program, I should say both hours of the program, to discussing those events. Let me welcome the guests that we do have in studio. Eileen Graham's here. Eileen is the founder of Black Student Leadership. And Eileen, as well, you're involved in some other efforts as well in our community. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, sir. I'm involved in organizing an event called Healing the Hurt. And it was as a result of the mass shooting that we had on Genesee Street or in front of the Boys and Girls Club. And we just basically come together as a healing network of family and community and leaders. And mainly our focus is on youth and empowering them to learn practical ways to respond to events like we're going through now, the stress, the trauma. And so we are working toward that. We follow the RCSD school calendar from September to June, so we're on break right now. We'll be starting up again in September.
And boy, we're coming up on just about a year from the Genesee, the shooting in front of the Boys and Girls Club, aren't we?
Yes, sir.
Wow. Let me also welcome Marv Stafferson. Marv is a retired police sergeant with 25 years of service with the RPD. He's a professor of criminal justice administration at Roberts Wesleyan College. And Marvin, thank you for being here. I said to you when you walked in, we got to stop meeting under these circumstances.
Yeah, I know, Evan. It certainly is not a pleasure under these circumstances. You know, like I said, it's been a year, and last time I was here was for the mass shooting. And I didn't sleep well last night, you know, watching and having a hard time turning the TV off, you know, just with more information flowing in. You know, it's a tough position being a retired officer and then also being Black. You know, you have a vested interest in both parties of the narrative that's being spun by the media. And so it's really a trying time right now.
Well, let's start and let's be very clear about what we saw in Dallas. Those police officers, that police department was not just sort of, I saw some people say, well, you know what, before that shooting, that protest, you know, the police were putting up with it. I said, they were not putting up with it. They were supporting that protest.
Yeah.
In fact, the Dallas Police Department was tweeting pictures of police arm in arm with protesters, basically saying, you know, you want to have a peaceful demonstration? We know you've got some tough things to say about policing around the country, but we are going to protect you, and we're going to make sure that you feel safe in your right to do that. They were being supportive, weren't they, Mar?
Yeah. Well, you got your number one and number two being African Americans, and so you know the culture that they're, you know, sending through their ranks is that, you know, in order for us to have a good community, a good department, we have to not only be diversified, but we have to think diversified. And that is being out there and embracing everybody's culture and embracing everybody's pain. And so, you know, they were out there supporting, as long as everything stayed orderly, supporting that healing process of going through and making sense of, you know, what's happening in across the country as it relates to the Black community and the officers' relationship.
I don't know. There's a lot we don't know about the suspect or suspects in this case. And mm-hmm. I think it is always prudent to try to wait and not assume that you know everyone's motivations. I mean, certainly it looks like not only were police targeted, but targeted in response to some of the events from this past week and recent years. But again, I think we don't fully know that yet. I do want to ask you, though, Marv, when you look at the Black Lives Matter movement, you look at the protests that are going on, there will be those, and there are those who are already using the murder of these police officers to say, see, that movement should be discredited. And it feels like two big steps back, fairly or unfairly, and it feels really unfair, in fact, to Black Lives Matter. But how do you feel about that, about grouping in that movement with the actions of either the suspect or suspects who targeted these police?
Well, just understanding history, you know that the Black Panther Party went through the same, you know, the same experience. They were doing things within the community, you know, to better the community, to strengthen the community, to create unity. And you had that 1% that was in there that did things that brought a negative image on the Panthers. And so same thing with Black Lives Matter. You have a negative entity that's not a part of the movement, but they're out there doing things under the name of the movement, and they're bringing a negative image. And we see that with Islam, you know, the radicals that are doing things and saying they're radical Islam. There's no such thing. If you really know about Islam, there's no radical Islam. Okay. And then when we look at the police department, the narrative is the same. There are negative persons within the police department that are doing things that make the entire department look negative to a certain demographic. And so if we all recognize that we share a similar experience within our own community, that there is that percentage that is representing us in a negative fashion, and deal with that entity, which means holding everybody accountable for their actions, then you won't see this backlash or, like, you know, Malcolm X says, chickens coming home to roost. You won't see that type of narrative, because we'll all understand that let's deal with the problem that's causing the injury. And then deal with supporting one another to heal.
Eileen, how do you feel?
And I think I have to agree. And it just, of course, my heart is broken. I'm sitting here holding back my tears because I think that we want this together. You know, Black, white, you know, everyone that's watching wants it. And we have allowed the 1%, that small percentage of people, to demonize our groups. You know, we're not anti, as a Black female, I'm not anti any other group, but I want to support my community, because I look in my community and I realize there are hurting people, there are barriers. You know, I've gone on Frost Avenue and talked to women who get their food stamps and buy lunch for three families, you know, so we don't represent whether this person is Black or white. You know, the Black Lives Matter movement does not represent killing people. We want the best for our children and our community. And, you know, we're resilient. And when I say we, I mean our community, people who support and speak out, the allies, those group of officers, I'm sure were allies. Or there were some in there. And so we cannot allow this to happen. We cannot sit back and say that this is okay. You know, watching our men be slaughtered on video is traumatizing. I did not sleep last night. I have a son who I can't help but look in his eyes and wonder if that would happen to him. And it's very hurtful. So we have to do this together. And we have to stick to it, and we have to let these people know, this 1%, that this is absolutely unacceptable.
Eileen, you mentioned having a child, and I want to relate a conversation I had this morning with a friend who happens to be Black. Because in the last week, you look at some of these events, I want to in particular, talk a little bit about Philando Castile, who was the man who was shot by a police officer outside St. Paul, Minnesota. And it seems that a lot of people can't understand how Philando Castile's girlfriend stayed so calm. If you watch that video, as hard as it is to watch, some people said, well, how could she stay so calm? You know, her boyfriend's been shot four times. Her four-year-old daughter's in the back seat. This morning, I spoke to a friend of mine who told me the following. He says, if you are black in America, you are having conversations right now about what to do if something like that mm-hmm. happens. And he said, you know that you may have to document it, or very few people will believe you. And my friend went on to say he would not be surprised if the woman who recorded that video had already had that conversation. That if this something like this ever happens, you got to keep your cool and you have to document it somehow. And he said it is horribly sad that black Americans are even having to make those kind of preparations. But he said he's had that conversation with his child. I mean, Eileen, what do you make of what he told me?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I posted that, of course, out of anger on my Facebook. Have I taught my son the tools or given him the tools that he needs to respond to a police officer if he's pulled over? Have I given him, you know, the proper programming, quotes, to not have an attitude, to not ask a question? You know, and it's very, I never thought I would be in this place where I just want to be treated the same. You know, if I'm pulled over and I'm doing something, or I'm speeding, or if I'm doing something and I ask a question, or I'm nervous and it appears to the officer that I have an attitude, I'm just afraid that I haven't given my son the tools to respond appropriately. And that's scary. I can't put into words, I can't articulate what that feels like, because my son is getting ready to go to California for school. And I'm concerned about that. And I should be concerned about making sure he has all the things that he needs for his dorm. You know, I'm concerned about that. Speaking with his dad last night, we're concerned about that. And it leaves you speechless for the purpose of speaking to the community and even speaking to the officers. It is very difficult to teach a child to have the right attitude in a moment of anxiety and fear. I don't know if it's possible.
Marv, you know, as a retired police officer, what do you make of those comments that my friend told me this morning about maybe that's why Philando Castile's girlfriend could keep it together at that moment, because she knows she's had to have that conversation in advance that if this happens.
Well, you know, I looked at the video and it was very difficult to watch. Yeah. And much like Eileen, my son is going into his second year at college and he's out of town, you know, away from my wife and I's, eyes and being able to see him and touch him and speak with him on a regular basis. And so the conversation, you know, as we call it, when I give consulting about diversity, we've had that conversation. I know other black men have had that conversation. You know, I've given him my experience as a black man because, you know, let's be honest, I don't wear the uniform any longer. And when I did wear it, I wore it for 8 hours. I didn't wear it all day. So I had to drive across town or out of state and run the risk of maybe going too fast and being pulled over and having to get beyond the prejudgment when that officer walks up of seeing me with my baseball cap turned backwards, my T-shirt on and jeans, and the tribbling bass mm-hmm. coming from my vehicle. Are you dealing with an officer or are you dealing with somebody you assume to be a threat because of your prejudgment of who I am? Mm. And so I had to give that conversation to my son. You don't do certain movements. You don't mm-hmm. make certain statements. Okay, you keep your hands where they can be seen, and you follow directions. And you have to go above being polite because you have to be calm for that person who may not have the cultural competency to see that you're 19 or you're 20. Because when Tamir Rice was shot, he didn't look 14 mm-hmm. to that officer. And that's based on his statement. And so we have to be cognizant mm-hmm. of the unfortunate that we're seeing in a different light. And so having the conversation, preparing our kids so that they go out there ready for the unknown, you know, that's why Castile's fiance was able to sit there and be poised, because she knew she had to be articulate We saw what happened with Mike Brown. Okay, we saw what happened with Trayvon Martin. When you have somebody who speaks on your behalf and they're not articulate, it's quickly dismissed. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's quickly to be said that there's no validity to this person because listen how unarticulate they are and or how uneducated they are. And we place that as a value of whether or not they're valid or credible. And that's the unfortunate. So the more articulate she was, the more poised she was, even though her four-year-old is sitting in the back seat, okay, which was in harm's way of being shot, the husband or the fiancé, rather, who was dying next to her, she couldn't go into the emotion of all that. She had to stay poised to get the story across so that everybody saw this, like we saw with Eric Garner, that something's not right. And so, you know, I love being an officer. I support my brothers and sisters out there. That job is not easy. You're judged on split-second decisions, and you have no wobble effect or no error margin that is similar to that of somebody working at Xerox or Kodak or some other place. Okay, you can't make those mistakes and then recover, and it's no harm, no foul. Out there, it could be life or death for someone or yourself. And so I understand the difficulties with that, but I know that a lot of that can be, you know, avoided if we use more discretion, wherein it's empathy, okay, wherein it's understanding, and that comes from sitting down and having that conversation on both sides.
Yeah, and Marv, I generally don't want to ask you to look at every single incident and say, what do you make of this? What do you make of this? You did bring up Philando Castile. You know, I know you saw the video. Do you see that video and are you uncomfortable with the scene you're seeing? I mean, do you feel like, of course, we didn't see everything that led up to that. The video starts after the shooting has happened. But do you at least think there are valid questions or at least a valid reason to feel like something is really wrong there?
Like you just mentioned, not having both sides of the narrative makes it difficult. I mean, certainly what comes into question with my viewing of it was that I hear the officer saying, I told him not to reach. But I never heard him say, start me medical. I never heard him say anything that says, I'm trying to preserve life. Okay. So I come into question of whether or not his statement was made so because he knew he was being recorded or if he was in shock himself and that was just coming out of his mouth. But from what we've heard from the governor, even his backup who got there, no one rendered this young man, Castile, medical aid or call for it. They call for it for one another. And see, that's when I was in the military, we were told we're expendable. What's important is the mission. And as law enforcement officers, we're told when you go out and serve and protect, you serve and protect everybody else and you sacrifice yourself. Mm-hmm. That's the whole premise of that job, is that you're out there to be the guardian for those that can't protect themselves. So that means that even if you have to render some type of force that may be serious physical injury or death, you have to then be able to turn that hat around and call for aid for that person, because regardless of what they've done or what they've said, they still are human beings, and we have to be in control enough of our own person to be able to see them as a human being and still try to help them, even if they cause the situation themselves.
Then let me ask both of you this question then. And Eileen, you can expand on the point because I know you want to jump back in here. And then we're going to go to your phone calls because I see the phone ringing. But Marv, do you understand, even without the full context of seeing everything that happened there, why Black Americans would look at that video and say, that does not happen to white people? That happens to us, and it happens time again. Do you understand why?
Yes, I definitely understand. I mean, like I said, I've been 50 years of Black, 25 years of law enforcement. So I was Black before I got on the job. I'm Black after I got on off the job.
Not a tan, right?
I can't wake up in the morning and take it off. I can take the uniform off, but I can't take off who I am. And unfortunately, I know that I've been viewed differently because of my difference in opinion on matters. I've had people tell me, oh, how could you be a cop thinking like you think? Mm. And you know, so now you're questioning my opinion. I can't question yours. So I get why the community feels this way. I understand it. But I also understand my officers. I understand the position that many of them good officers are placed in because of decisions by some officers that are questionable.
Mm-hmm. All right, Eileen.
And I sit and listen and I think about how can we be proactive, because these two crimes should not be. And when we look at the list and how it ends up with other, you know, Tamir Rice, no one's held accountable. So now we have a group of angry, a country of angry people. So how do we get in front of this? I don't have the answer, but my suggestion would be cultural humility. Before you can even be competent in anything, you have to be humble and you have to put yourself and meet people where they are, not where you are. Because a lot of times if I'm in a situation and I'm nervous, because I've been there, I've been pulled over for speeding. And when Sandra Bland was, you know, I never had that feeling until that happened. And because I like progression, I like, how can we move forward? How can we turn this extreme pain into purpose? And what does that look like? Being proactive to me is having a conversation with someone like Marv and being honest and being transparent and saying, we may be in a situation, but we want to be treated fairly. We want to be treated like everyone else. You know, I think about when I watched Selma and the president asked Martin Luther King, we don't say Negroes anymore, but what do you Negroes want? We want to be treated like everyone else in a situation. What happened to arresting people? You know, you know, if I am in a situation and you were unhappy with my response, it's not a justifiable reason to shoot me. And so being proactive in my mind is moving from the conversation and in that moment in time, making a decision that will not only save your life, it will save the person's life that you're supposed to neutralize and bring balance to it. And so making it more hostile is just, to me, is why we keep having these situations and these conversations, and we're all traumatized and we're all hurt and trying to figure it out and how can we do it together. And so in this state of feeling, just my heart is broken. I'm still willing to talk to, I reached out to Captain McMullen and some of the other officers that I know would support this. But I need you to speak up. I need you to get in the face of the enemy that we're fighting, you know, and saying this is unacceptable.
These are the moments, Eileen, that I think, you know, go have lunch with someone who looks different than you.
Right.
Go buy a beer for someone who thinks differently than you. You know, find someone who you think, I cannot believe they think this way. I can't believe they vote this way. I have no idea how they feel that way. And just go talk to them for an hour and listen. You know, I got to do it too. I think we all do. We talk about a segregated America. We're segregated by race in many ways. We're segregated in sort of thought, you know, and ways of life. We got to break it down somehow. You know, that's where to start. I'm going to get to your phone calls. If you want to call the program, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255. You're hearing this hour from Eileen Graham, the founder of Black Student Leadership and Healing the Hurt in Rochester. And Reverend Lewis Stewart's going to be here in the next half hour. He's with United Church Ministries. Also in studio with us is Marvin Stefferson. He is a retired police sergeant, 25 years in service with RPD. He's also a professor for criminal justice administration at Roberts Wesleyan College. Drew in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Drew.
Hi, I know Marvin, and he was a great cop, but I want to say this here quickly. He mentioned ISIS, which is like he's saying 1% of the population of Muslims that's doing bad things. They're being attacked by the United States military. They're being punished for what they're doing. These police officers who are doing bad things have not really been punished. Mm-hmm. They've been exonerated for obvious stuff that we've seen on video. Two, Tamir Rice, I want him to answer this question. Is that the correct protocol for approaching a man with a gun running up to a kid in the car and shooting him within 2 seconds from like within 5 feet? I just want to know if that's correct protocol. I think size has nothing to do with it. The fact that he was a kid that they thought had a gun, and those cops ran up on him, and one cop shouldn't have even been on the force. So if he can answer that question for us, I would be, you know, more, I would just like to hear his answer on that. And it does seem to be a double standard. There was a study that was done years ago that said that white officers react quickly to black suspects as opposed to white suspects.
All right, Drew.
In a more aggressive way.
All right, Drew, hang on the line. Stay there. Marv, go ahead.
Hey, Drew, thank you for your compliment. I just want to say real quickly that, you know, when looking at the case with Tamir Rice, again, you had, like you said, an officer that should not have been on the force with Cleveland had this screening been done properly from the agency that he was let go of. But still, we're talking about tactics now. We're talking about approaching the shooting or rather approaching the call for the man with the gun. Okay, we know that the dispatchers didn't do their due diligence of relaying the information of it possibly being an imitation gun. We know that the veteran officer, the FTO, was driving and approached and placed the rookie officer who did the shooting in a very compromised position. As being an officer that taught tactics and firearms and whatnot, it's very difficult to question someone's tactics after it's done, because you have to respond when you're in that moment. Mm-hmm. And so although I don't agree with the approach, because I think that had the approach been done differently, it could have been a different outcome. I do know that having been an officer out on the street, you know, anybody that has a weapon is a threat. And that, you know, if you got split second decision time, or whether or not you're going to, you know, save your life or the life of someone else. And you don't know the person's intent or their heart until the actions have been, acted upon. So I question the approach. I question a lot of things that surround that particular incident. And I think, like I said, cultural competency, there's a lot of moving pieces to this that created that perfect storm.
And Marv, just Drew's other point was, or at least the question was, are we at least seeing documentation that you mentioned in that split second you got to decide what to do? You have to rely on training. I don't think the vast majority of police officers are overtly racist, but Drew's question points at, are you more likely to respond with more force if you're a police officer who happens to be white and the person you are approaching is black? Is that something that we are seeing?
I think that we're seeing it because the numbers of white male officers outnumber that of female, Asian, Hispanic, African-American, or that other bracket. So when you have a large populace that is out there policing a populace that is largely black and brown, any type of force, any type of altercation is going to have those types of numbers wherein it's upside down. You know, and I think that they've shown that male white officers have shot more white suspects, but again, when you look at per capita, black suspects or black persons, shall I say, male and female alike, have been disproportionately shot.
Yeah. So, Drew, any follow up there? Go ahead.
Yeah, I understand that somewhat, but I still disagree with it, because just getting back to Tamir Rice, I have family and friends in law enforcement, and they told me that usually when you hear of a suspect having a gun, you kind of like cordon off the area, and they saw where the kid was. So rather than even give him a chance to say, put the gun down or anything, they just ran up and shot him. I don't think it was a split-second decision to shoot him. They could have approached him from a distance like they've done with other suspects with guns. And you know, it's on Facebook all the time. You see a black guy with a gun, and you see a white officer getting out the car and ducking behind the car and saying, put the gun down. But you see a white guy with a gun in an open carry state, and he's approached differently. And we see this. I mean, I'm not saying we see this.
No, I agree that the approach, you have a lot of examples out there where there's been more discretion, more patience, more steps been taken. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But again, we're going back to the comfort level. A male white dealing with another male white, there is that view of, I see that person as me, as my brother, as my son. So therefore, that threat is lessened. But when you look at somebody that's different than you,
Something to fear.
Mm-hmm. And so, that's a reality.
Should we have more officers reflecting the community? That's what you're saying, right?
I say that
regardless of test scores or not.
No, what I'm saying is that there needs to be more exposure to one another's cultures and understanding, because you have some black officers who were raised in a different culture and have that same cultural ideology, okay, even though they share the same melanin. Mm-hmm. So we can't say that it's just because the black officer is not going to shoot a black person. That's not the case.
But Marv, we've also had a chance to speak to the chief of Rochester Police about this issue, and he pointed to a couple things. First of all, after Ferguson, a lot of people were looking at the numbers, and I don't remember offhand. I think there were, 3 out of 53 officers or something like that in Ferguson were African-American when it was a predominantly black community, and that was obviously viewed with some concern. In Rochester, I think we were around a quarter of the force, and I know that I don't have the number offhand, so don't go to me right now for a solid statistic, other than to say we have more diversity per capita in the Rochester Police Department than Ferguson did, for example. Yeah. But the chief wants to see more of it, and they've been reaching out to get more of it. To Marv's point, that doesn't solve everything.
No,
that doesn't mean you won't have confrontation. That doesn't mean you won't have problems. But that, I think that certainly is a valid goal, make it look a little more like a community.
Well, it might be a quick fix. It might alleviate some. But still, you have to change the culture.
Yeah,
You change the culture, then everybody will share. Because we looked at yesterday's march. It was very diverse across New York, across Dallas. You didn't just see all black people walking. Mm-hmm. You saw everybody, from all different ethnicities walking. So we all understand humanity has no real color. Mm-hmm. But that changing of the culture will then change how we view one another. And then it won't have to worry about whether or not it's a very diverse department or not.
Eileen?
And I don't know if I thanked you, but I thank you for, allowing this platform, because a lot of times we sit and we listen and just having this opportunity to say, come and talk to us. Because even within the black community, we need to do that. We need to be interdependent. We need to talk to each other. We need to find out what the barriers are. We need to, just engage. When you get engaged to someone, you take the time to get to know them and not judge them based on what you see or what you think, because the value system is so strong within. I mean, I live in the Genesee area community, and so I talk to people. If I go to the laundromat, I leave my phone in the car on purpose to just have a conversation with people, find out what their needs are. What are we looking at? I think officers need to take the time to do that, immersing yourself into the community that you serve. I don't personally believe in making people live somewhere that they don't want to live, but it is very important, because then when things happen and you need to respond, you will respond appropriately, because you have built a relationship with the people that live in this community. We don't know how to engage each other. We don't know how to agree to disagree. And so we believe the narrative that we see on the news, on social media. We believe that. We have kind of digested all of this propaganda. And so we start treating people based on a virtual reality of what we think. And we respond in reality, and we have what we have in front of us within a week. Our week as a community, as a world, has been horrible. But how do we take the narrative and say, okay, this is what we must do in that moment in time? Because I know you. Now I have a relationship with you.
All right. Let me grab another phone call. This is Kobe in Springwater. Go ahead.
Hello. I want to thank you, Evan, and your guests for having this conversation.
Sure.
So I think that part of the problem with public perception is that, for instance, I'm a nurse, and in my profession, we do not tolerate our colleagues harming our patients. Mm-hmm. We make sure that those individuals are identified, prosecuted, if applicable, terminated, disciplined, whereas I think the public sees the police responding to these challenges by denial, pretending that nothing's wrong, becoming defensive. We need to see a more open process where they are, instead of protecting one another when things go wrong, that they're trying to identify problem individuals and getting them out of there.
Yeah, Kobe, thank you for the phone call. I think that's, I have said many times in conversations with friends, when we criticize police for the occasional bad actions, we are supporting police. Mm-hmm. We are showing the kind of support that holds up the good actions of the many while criticizing the poor actions of the few, that seeks to make things better for everybody. That is supporting police. I don't know why we have this weird state where if you criticize any police for anything, it's attacking all police. Mm-hmm. It's not.
Right.
Marv, you were an officer for 25 years. Did you ever see a single police officer do anything wrong? My guess is you did. And my guess is you would never, and I'm not saying the worst, I'm saying, you know, showed up late for work or, you know, ran a red light, talked on a cell phone while I was driving. I've seen police officers
yes.
do that. I want to just tell you. I've seen it, okay?
Me too.
When we criticize that, that's supporting police, just as in your own company, in your own family,
yeah.
when you criticize people for doing wrong, that's how you make it better.
Yeah.
Right.
Right? And then that part of Kobe's point is we got to be a little bit more willing, all of us, to take criticism, to learn from it and do better. And these are those moments, right?
I agree. I think that, you know, the biggest thing is we have to know what it is we want when we say holding accountability.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Because the fear of the police is that, well, if we hold or open, should I say, the door to precedent of holding someone accountable and all they want is firing or locking up,
right.
where is that learning from your mistake?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. We want everybody to be real gingerly dealt with in the community, but the police, mm-hmm. heavy hand. And so the police are like saying, well, we're not going to allow any type of measure to be taking place on us because now it's going to be open season. And so I think the community, when they come forward and say, okay, we want you held accountable, let's look at the layers of accountability. What is going to be the punishment? And not go for the extreme right mm-hmm. off the back, because the extreme creates fear, and then the fear makes everybody circle the wagons and go into defense mode. I mean, we see that within our
power
own
struggles.
Household when we talk about husband and wife relationship. If the husband says something defensive, mm-hmm. you know, says something offensive to the wife, she's going to go into defense mode mm-hmm. and then point the finger at his error. So those simplistic measures can be taken and placed mm-hmm. on the police department as well. Yeah, if the police does something that's not appropriate, then let's look at some measures of doing some, retraining or something that will create a level of trust wherein they're saying, mm-hmm. okay, we did mess up, but you're allowing us to refix that, to go back and make good on that. So mm-hmm. now the police will be more willing, more engaging to being held accountable, because it's not that extreme of locking me up forever or, you know, taking my livelihood away.
Sure. And look, quick programming note here, because things are a little off kilter. We were a little late starting this hour because we were waiting for Loretta Lynch's statement, which you heard live here. So we are going to go right up towards the top of the hour. We'll get a regular break off the top of the hour, and we'll come back and we'll spend roughly the first half hour of the next hour staying on this subject. So if you're on the phone and waiting, we will be able to get to more of your calls, etc. I wanted to read, a couple of people have emailed a link to an article that I had already seen this morning, but I just want to respond to some of the emailers to the program who are saying, did you see what Matt Lewis wrote? Matt Lewis is a conservative writer for the Daily Caller. He wrote the book called Too Dumb to Fail, and he was on this program talking about that. Now, listen, he's a conservative. He wants to see the Republicans win, but he says not with Trump, and he says he's disappointed in his party, and he wants to see Republicans sort of make a better shift in a smarter direction. He wrote a piece this morning called A Confession, and I just want to read a little bit from this because a lot of people are sharing this. Matt is a white male conservative, and here's what he writes in his piece called A Confession. Quote, in the era of Facebook Live and smartphones, it's hard to come to any conclusion other than the fact that police brutality toward African Americans is a pervasive problem that has been going on for generations. Seriously, absent video proof, how many innocent African Americans have been beaten or killed over the last 100 years by the police with little or no media coverage or scrutiny? There's no telling the damage this has done to us collectively, not to mention the specific families and individuals that were victimized. I was brought up to reflexively believe the police, to give them the benefit of the doubt. This was before everyone had a camera and before my own personal experience would demonstrate to me that not all cops are heroes, though some certainly are. It was also before I became a dad and could appreciate the fear that many African-American parents have regarding their children's interactions with police. This default assumption that the police officer was always right is, I'm sure, what a lot of well-meaning and decent middle-class white people were raised to believe. Sure, there were incidents of police abuse, we were told, but those were very rare, and mostly they happened in the Deep South. If you had to take someone's word, you always go with the police officer over some random citizen. And let's be honest, for many Americans, that was especially true if that citizen was a minority. But now, decent Americans cannot turn a blind eye to police abuse. They just didn't really believe it was happening, or maybe they didn't want to believe. Today, there is literally no excuse to be ignorant of the problem. End quote. That's Matt Lewis, a conservative writer, writing a piece this morning called A Confession. About 30 seconds, Marv, what do you think?
I think he's spot on. You know, I vote my interests, so I can't say, even though I'm Democrat, that I don't believe in some of the Republican issues or points brought up. I think that there are some things that need to be fixed. You know, do I point the finger and blame the president for all of it? No, I think there's a collective responsibility from Congress and the president. So I don't knock the Republicans. And at the same time, I do understand where some of their resentment comes from based upon the direction of the country.
And Eileen, you know, Matt is saying as a white parent, he is now getting a better sense of what black parents like you are going through with your kids when he sees these videos. And he's basically saying, I'm trying to own it. I'm trying. What do you make of that?
I celebrate that. And I think sometimes it's as simple as making that public statement and letting, you know, people that look like you know we can't be afraid, because we do need help with pushing that agenda and pushing that love and pushing that empathy. You know, so many people are apathetic that it is sickening. And so I celebrate him writing that publicly and stating that and understanding that pain.
All right. Well, let's get our only short break here. We're going to come back to your phone calls, and you're going to hear what Dan Varenti said. He's the chief of police at Brockport. He's also the president of the Monroe County Police Chiefs Association. He had a different take on this. He had a chance to talk to our Randy Gorbin this morning. His comments coming up in just a few minutes, and more of your phone calls as well on Connections.